This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you would like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
That's the very smart blue card. This is Radio Fax with Trevor Brooke
and Maggie Stevenson.
From Electronics Weekly, gallium arsenide device takes FETs to be what beyond 100 gigahertz by Richard Wilson. Gallium arsenide technology is now offering devices that are capable of operating beyond 100 gigahertz. An ALGAAS modulation doped field effect transistor, MOSFET, has been developed at the Siemens Research Laboratory in Princeton, New Jersey, in cooperation with Cornell University, that has a unity gain cutoff frequency, FT, of 113 GHz. This is claimed to be the highest measured FT for any type of FET by the scientists at the Princeton Laboratory. The design offers FTs that are 50% higher than those for any previously reported MOSFET. Further performance improvements are expected using more advanced material structures, such as super lattice buffers, and the fabrication of epitaxial layers using indium gallium arsenide. It is believed that these enhancements could push performance up to 200 GHz. This will be of interest to those governmental bodies responsible for the management of the radio spectrum. The boom in mobile communications has rapidly eaten up the spectrum below 1 GHz using equipment based largely on silicon technology. The next generation of equipment, which will operate above 1 GHz, will probably use GAAS technology. However, experience has taught the regulators to look even further into the future. This resulted in last month's announcement from the Department of Trade and Industry regarding the use of the radio spectrum between 30 GHz up to 100 GHz. Of course, the development of commercial products at an affordable price based on this Siemens research are many years away. In fact, most GAAS technology is still too expensive to be attractive to commercial equipment manufacturers. But the work goes on, and the limits are all the time being pushed, so that one day the scientists will offer the regulators the means to overcome the congested airways of today.
And now a tribute to Alexander Graham Bell, which was written by the National Geographic magazine very recently, which goes in depth into quite a wide range of the work that he did. Everyone knows that Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, and on that point at least, what everyone knows happens to be true. But there is another common belief that runs afoul of the Bell story. Nowadays we take it for granted that success depends on specialising, keeping one's eye on the ball. So thought most people in Bell's day too. Put all your eggs in the one basket, wrote Mark Twain, and watch that basket. We might suppose, therefore, that Bell proceeded on the one-basket plan. Fortunately, he did not. If he had, he would never have invented the telephone. It was simply not in Bell's nature to fixate for long on the one basket. All his life he retained a child's joy in the world's diversity. But before he became world-famous, Bell's love of diversity raised misgivings in some who knew him. His prospective father-in-law chided him for his tendency to undertake every new thing that interests you and accomplish nothing of any value to anyone. That was less than 5 months before the telephone was patented. What saved him from mere aimless skittering was his capacity for total absorption in the concern of the moment, another trait which might be called childlike. My mind, he once wrote, concentrates itself on the subject that happens to occupy it, and then all things else in the universe, including father, mother, wife, children, life itself, become for the time being of secondary importance. If those traits were innate, external circumstances confirmed them, beginning with the Scottish city where he was born in 1847. In its very contours, Edinburgh encouraged a roving eye and spirit. Some cities convey their impatience with a horizontal, the urge to be up and doing, through the work of human hands, cathedrals, towers, skyscrapers. In others, nature lends a hand. They are cities upon hills, and Edinburgh was that kind of town. Young Bell's favourite vantage spot was Corstorphine Hill. From it ran a grand view over the elegant new town and Leith docks to the sea. On the crest of Corstorphine, the boy was close to the sky, and below him circled the alluring horizon. Lying at peace on the grassy slope, Alec watched the birds make their mysterious way, and this more than all else stirred his envy and wonder. Something more than terrain, however, made Edinburgh a tonic to the mind. Its own people, and others too, called it the Athens of the North, as well as Auld Reekie for its coal smoke. For generations, Edinburgh had been a centre of culture second only to London in the British Empire. The glorious tradition of David Hume in philosophy, Adam Smith in economics, Robert Burns and Sir Walter Scott in literature, James Hutton in geology, and the great civil engineer, Thomas Telford, in technology, remained strong in Bell's boyhood. The University of Edinburgh had long maintained a faculty ranking with the world's best, especially in science and medicine. The hallmark of the Edinburgh mind was exuberant versatility. Another son of Edinburgh, Robert Louis Stevenson, 3 years Alec Bell's junior, quite naturally included in his child's garden of verses a jaunty couplet: "The world is so full of a number of things, I'm sure we should all be as happy as kings." Bell's own family embodied the Edinburgh spirit. Alec stood in awe of his father, Alexander Melville Bell, a successful elocutionist and speech teacher. As befitted his vocation, the elder Bell was a man of impressive bearing and fine address. Lecturing regularly at the University of Edinburgh, coaching teachers, ministers, and the children of titled families, he kept in touch with the intelligentsia of the city. More than that, he qualified as one of them by research and publication. For years, he pursued a century-old dream of elocutionists and phoneticians, scientifically analysing vocal sounds in order to develop a complete and universally applicable system of phonetic notation. At last, in 1864, he achieved his goal with a system he called visible speech. Alec, in his late teens, became adept in it and helped his father demonstrate it to linguists and phoneticians in London as well as Edinburgh. They hailed it as a major advance. Alec's mother, Eliza Bell, had meanwhile added still another dimension to her son's widening world. Though her hearing was severely impaired, she was a good pianist, achieving feedback by fastening her ear tube to her ear and resting the mouthpiece on the soundboard. The bond between mother and son was strong. More than his two brothers, Alec, as a child, had a knack for bypassing the ear tube and communicating in a low voice close to her forehead. He too showed pianistic talent and studied for a time with a leading pianist, dreaming of glory as a virtuoso. Then his teacher died, and the dream too. Science also captured the boy's imagination. He collected botanical specimens until the drudgery of memorizing nomenclature dulled his fervour. Zoology engaged him for a while. He had no heart to kill for science, but when chance or nature supplied dead specimens, he explored their insides, and he tried his hand at technology. The father of a playmate owned an old gristmill on a nearby stream, a fascinating place for the two boys to play. One day, wearying of their cavorting, the miller challenged them to do something useful, such as taking the husks off the grain. Alec set about experimenting and came up with a workable device involving rotating paddles in a brush-lined cylinder. That, he wrote many years later, was my first incentive to invention. Thus early, Alec Bell whirled around happily on a carousel of hobby horses, phonetics, physiology, pianos, deafness, invention, elocution, the flight of birds, and the intoxicating panorama of the wide world. Yet for all their seeming incongruity, hindsight reveals a prophetic convergence, a concealed focus, the art, science and technology of communication. A hint of what lay ahead came with a project the elder Bell urged on Alec and his older brother Melville in 1863. At 16, Alec was just back from a year with his paternal grandfather, who taught speech in London. The old man had polished Alec's elocution, held him to serious reading and study, instilled in him ideas of social and political democracy, and converted him, as Alec later wrote, from a boy somewhat prematurely into a man. Cut off from his friends of his own age, however, Alec had come home graver and more withdrawn than before, resentful of now being treated as a boy again. So his father challenged him and Melville to collaborate in making a speaking machine, a device for mechanical production of vocal sounds, one such as Alec and his father had lately seen in London. After studying a lamb's larynx given them by a butcher, the boys constructed a model of the vocal organs, which could be shaped and positioned by levers. Operating by blowing through a tube, it made voice-like sounds. The project helped rekindle Alec's youthful spirit, and as the father doubtless also intended, it heightened his fascination with mechanisms of speech. The fascination carried over when Alec at last tasted independence as a teenage instructor for two boys at a school in Elgin on the north coast of Scotland. With his musical ear and some ingenious experiments with tuning forks and various shapings of his mouth and throat cavities, he found that each vowel sound is a compound of two pitches, and that in a certain sequence one rises and the other falls as the sequence progresses. What was more, he deduced the psychological basis of the phenomenon. Like the paired pitches, Bell's spirits both rose and fell when he learned from a London phonetician that the great scientist Hermann von Helmholtz had already made the same discovery. Helmholtz had reached the finish line first, to be sure, and that was disappointing. But the 19-year-old Bell had independently run the same course, and that was grounds for pride. More important, Bell was intrigued by Helmholtz's device for keeping each of his tuning forks vibrating, an intermittent electrical current of the same frequency as the fork's natural vibrations, activating an electromagnet near the fork. Bell told friends that someone someday would go on to transmit speech and music by telegraphy. After Elgin, Bell taught in a boys' preparatory school at Bath, England, meanwhile tinkering with batteries and telegraphic instruments. But his younger brother, Edward, died of tuberculosis that year, leaving his parents alone in his late grandfather's house on Harrington Square, Albert. Sir Alec, now 20, joined them and took up the family vocation of phonetics and speech training. At a nearby private school in 1868, the young man first tried his skill at teaching speech to deaf children, four bright little girls. Perhaps his mother's deafness gave him a special feeling for them. With the help of visible speech and Bell's talent as a teacher, the girls learned quickly and joyously. Alec had found his true calling. Even after inventing the telephone, he would write, "Of one thing I became more sure every day, that my interest in the deaf is to be a lifelong thing with me." And true to his word, he would list teacher of the deaf as his profession to the end of his days, notwithstanding a perennial counterpoint of other pursuits. Thank you. music remained one of those other interests. Playing the piano at Harrington Square, Alec became fascinated with the phenomenon of sympathetic vibration. By singing into the piano, he could sound the wire that matched the pitch of his voice. He noticed also that the sound of a piano chord coming through a thin wall from the adjoining apartment was faintly echoed by the corresponding wires of his piano. The foreshadowings of a momentous concept therefore formed in Bell's mind. If the different frequencies of several tuning forks were transmitted simultaneously over a single wire, they, like the piano chord, could be separated out by similarly tuned forks at the other end. Thus, a number of Morse code messages could be sent at the same time over a single wire. But other events jostled this notion into the background. In 1870, Alec's older brother, Melville, died, also of that Victorian scourge, tuberculosis. His father, on a recent professional tour of North America, had been captivated by the go-ahead spirit and bracing climate there. An invitation to give a lecture series in Boston now inspired him to make a new world home near some transplanted Scottish friends in Brantford, Ontario. In the hope of saving his only remaining son from the fate of the other two, he persuaded Alec to come along. The elder Bells settled comfortably in an ample house outside Brantford, amid 12 acres of woods, fruit trees and outbuildings, on a high bluff overlooking the Grand River. When the elder Bell, warmly received in Boston, was asked to introduce the visible speech method there at a new school for deaf children, he referred the offer to Alec, who accepted it eagerly. Boston was an American Edinburgh, even to claiming the title Athens of America, as well as the self-mocking nickname Hub of the Solar System. Harvard, the nation's oldest college, was about to become a true university under Charles W. Eliot, and other schools like Boston College, MIT and Boston University had sprung up in the 1860s to enrich the academic scene. Boston businessmen were developing mines and railroads in the West, while industry and commerce continued to prosper at home. Most significant for Alec's future, Boston was the leading centre of American science and technology, including electricity. On his own at last, Bell flourished in Boston. His visible enthusiasm made all the more dramatic by his jet-black hair and expressive face communicated itself to deaf pupils, and his resonant, well-modulated voice also charmed Bostonians who could hear. Impressed by his results, other schools invited him to demonstrate his methods. In 1873, he joined the faculty of Boston University as professor of vocal physiology, thus gaining status in academic circles. Meanwhile, Bell somehow found time and energy to pursue science and invention. Boston's intellectual strengths invited that. On the day of his arrival, someone had given him a copy of John Tyndall's new work on sound, and he learned that MIT had a complete set of Helmholtz's apparatuses. In 1872, at a Michigan convention of deaf school principals, he delivered a paper in which he described speech scientifically as a mere motion of the air, a series of undulations. That October, he heard Tyndall lecture in Boston on the undulatory theory of light propagation. During the same month, the newspaper in which Bell advertised his speech lessons reported that Western Union had paid handsomely for rights to another Boston inventor's duplex telegraph, by which an ingenious arrangement of circuits could transmit a message in each direction simultaneously over a single wire. That was probably what turned Bell's mind back to his London concept of a multiple telegraph on the quite different plan of superimposed frequencies. Bell began working feverishly, experimenting by night while teaching by day, thus confirming his lifelong night owl habits. Then, in the spring of 1874, a well-received lecture he gave at MIT on speech training for the deaf brought Bell an invitation to use the Institute's apparatuses and laboratories. This turned him from telegraphy to acoustics. One device especially caught his eye because it made speech visible. Called a phonautograph, it had a diaphragm with an attached bristle that, while vibrating in response to a vocal sound, traced an undulating curve on a strip of smoke glass being drawn past it. That summer, at the Dreaming Place on the Brantford Bluff, watching the Grand River meander sinuously far below, Bell let a kaleidoscope of miscellaneous notions swirl about in his mind. Complex sound vibrations conveyed through a single point by the phonautograph diaphragm expressed as a wavy line. The surprising power of sound waves to move small bones in the ear. Complex undulatory electrical currents generated by the vibration of a magnetized reed and passing over a single wire. Piano strings echoing a voice. Suddenly the jumble fused into a great insight, the fundamental principle of the telephone. His magnificently simple inspiration depended on no scientific discovery or natural phenomenon that had not been well known for nearly half a century. Why had no one thought of it before Bell did? Many an expert on electricity, and on electricity alone, asked himself that question when he heard of it. Bell's fellow native of Edinburgh, the great physicist James Clerk Maxwell, had an answer. "I consider the telephone," said Maxwell in his last public lecture, "as a material symbol of the widely separate departments of human knowledge, the cultivation of which has led by as many converging paths to the invention of this instrument by Professor Graham Bell." The electrical experts had put all their eggs in one basket and watched only that basket. Committed to the telegraph, they couldn't stand back far enough to see the promise of a radically different approach to communication. Even if they had seen it, their electrical expertise would have suggested more technical barriers than openings. In going on to make the telephone a reality, Bell drew on Boston's varied resources. Boston scientists and technologists assured him that his idea was theoretically sound. Fortunately, one of them dated notes of their discussion in October 1874. The shop of Charles Williams, Jr. was a centre of custom work for electrical inventors. Young Thomas Edison had frequented it not long before, and there Bell engaged the skills of 20-year-old Tom Watson to help in the experimental work. In March 1876, Watson clinched his place in history as the first to answer a telephone call. Financing came from two Yankee businessmen, Gardner Green Hubbard and Thomas Sanders, each of whom had a deaf child under Bell's tutelage. Bell had fallen in love with one of those pupils, 17-year-old Mabel Hubbard. During the summer and fall of 1875, in the spirit of folk tales and Victorian romances, he won the promise of her hand over her parents' opposition. The Hubbards had thought her too young to make such a decision. In due course, they would marry and live happily ever after, but the courtship delayed the framing and filing of his telephone patent. So did his Boston University classes and private pupils, and likewise his insistence on waiting for word about his application for a British patent. "I rushed from one thing to another, and before I know it, the day is gone," he wrote to his parents. Finally, Gardner Hubbard lost his patience and took it upon himself to file the patent application on the 14th of February, 1876. For a few years, Bell accepted the nominal role of technical advisor to the telephone company. Even so, true to his temperament, he refused all along to be bound to that or any other single line of work, including his university position. To him, the financial independence, though not a great fortune, that the telephone gave him, meant instead that he could yield happily to his bent for variety. And yield he did for the more than four decades left to him. He kept on inventing. After a long honeymoon in England and Scotland, he and his wife settled near her parents in Washington, D.C., where he set up his own laboratory. Impressed by Thomas Edison's Menlo Park invention factory, he tried to replicate it on a small scale, but his approach to invention was different. Edison tended to identify a commercial need and then look for a way to a physical phenomenon and then look for a way to use it. In 1873, for example, the element selenium had been found to have a strange property. Its electrical conductivity increased with the intensity of the light that fell on it. Intrigued by the effect, Bell saw that if a light could be varied in intensity by the sound of a voice, the light could be beamed over a distance to affect selenium as the reliable resistance element in a telephone transmitter. Thus, speech could be transmitted without wires. With the help of a young technician named Sumner Tainter, whom he hired as the equivalent of Tom Watson, Bell produced his photophone in 1880. Until the end of his life, Bell insisted that it was the greatest invention I have ever made, greater than the telephone, perhaps because he hated to admit that his career as inventor had peaked when he was 29, but the photophone had a range of only a few hundred feet, and then only if there were no fog, rain, snow, smoke, or intervening obstacles to obscure its beam, so it had no commercial value. In 1881, Bell did, like Edison, invent for a practical purpose. President James A. Garfield lay slowly dying from the wound of an assassin's bullet that surgeons could not locate. Working nearly round the clock, Bell came up with two devices to help out. One was an adaptation of the induction balance, which worked like a present-day mine detector by changing a telephone tone when it passed over metal. The other was a telephonic probe, combining a needle with a telephone receiver so as to produce an audible click when it touched metal. But the bullet was too deep for the induction balance to detect, and the surgeons chose not to try the probe, though afterwards it was much used until X-rays supplanted it. So Garfield, that brave spirit, as Bell said of the president, died. In the same sad summer, the Bell's newborn son died from respiratory failure. His parents' grief spurred Bell to invent a vacuum jacket, an airtight iron cylinder surrounding a patient's torso up to the neck, and fitted to that a pump that could rhythmically rise and lower air pressure inside, thus compressing and expanding the lungs. The device anticipated the iron lung developed 5 decades later for polio victims. In the early 1880s, Bell turned the tables on Edison. A few years before, Edison had leapfrogged Bell by inventing the carbon button transmitter, which made the telephone more effective. Bell now took up Edison's phonograph, which Edison had let remain a laboratory toy, its recording short, poor in quality, good only for a few days, and not adaptable for mass duplication. In improving the phonograph, Bell was more the manager of his team than an active player. He relied chiefly on his cousin, Chichester Bell, and Sumner Tainter. The team's patents helped make the phonograph commercially viable and bought them several $100,000. Bell used his share to endow research on deafness. Bell continued to lead a busy life, but for a few years, invention took a back seat to other activities. One of them, in the late 1880s, was the creation of a Northern Eden, a summer retreat near Bedeck, Nova Scotia, to which she gave the Gaelic name Bean Bray, pronounced Bean Vray, meaning beautiful mountain. Though he became a United States citizen, he was soon dividing his year between Bean Bray and Washington. By then, as he approached his 40s, Bell's mien had grown appropriately baronial. Soon after inventing the telephone, he began to put on weight, and accepted, indeed expected, mark of Victorian success. From the slender, dark-haired suitor of Mabel Hubbard, Alec, as she spelled it, became her stout, prematurely graying husband. On their honeymoon, he'd grown a connective copse of whiskers between his sideburns, and now rivaled the physical presence of his uncle David Bell, whom George Bernard Shaw once characterised as by far the most majestic and imposing-looking man that ever lived on this or any other planet. Alec and Mabel made a striking couple. With a heritage of Yankee leanness, she remained slim and graceful all her life, the picture of elegance on formal occasions. Her startling facility in speech reading helped her feel at ease in such gatherings, and her sometimes reserved judgment into more social contacts. They leaned on each other. "Deaf-mutes, gravitation, or any other hobby has been too apt to take the first place in my thoughts," he wrote her once, "and yet you've grown into my heart and taken root there, and you cannot be plucked out without tearing it to pieces." They needed that mutual support when their two sons died in infancy, losses that haunted them throughout their later lives. But their daughters, Elsie and Miriam, known to the family as Daisy, both destined to long life, not only gave them comfort and joy, but also in time a growing clan of descendants. 7 children were born to Elsie and her husband Gilbert H. Grosvenor, including Melville Bell Grosvenor, in youth a lively companion for his grandfather, and in maturity his father's successor at the helm of the National Geographic magazine. Daisy and her husband, the noted botanist David Fairchild, added 3 more to the roster of Bell descendants. With all these, as well as the Bells' parents and other relatives by blood or marriage, there were times when the big house at Breen Brae had to accommodate as many as 25 besides the servants. Such occasions helped draw the host from his shell. Mabel's sister noted that he's quite a different person here from what he is in Washington. Here he's the life and soul of the party. This is not to say that Bell was never crusty, even in Washington. I never felt at ease with anyone until I met him, recalled Annie Sullivan, Helen Keller's beloved teacher. Bell had a happy way of making people feel pleased with themselves, of bringing out the best that was in them. Still, he often yielded to his inner reserve. Even at the weekends, he spent them alone in an unpretentious sanctum, a houseboat beached in a secluded cove, and throughout his life, he found congenial solitude in reflection and study through the wee hours while all the rest of the household slept. continuing the tribute to Alexander Graham Bell by the National Geographic magazine. In Nova Scotia, the amplitude of Bell's acreage opened a new field for his inventive instincts when they revived in 1891. The wonder of flight had long possessed him. Now he had space to try his wings. For a few years, he puttered with gunpowder rockets for propulsion, with pinwheel helicopter rotors, with spring-powered models, with little monoplanes. "The more I experiment," he wrote in 1893, "the more convinced I become that flying machines are practical." With characteristic enthusiasm, he told a reporter in 1896, "I believe it will be possible in a very few years for a person to take his dinner in New York at 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening and eat his breakfast in either Ireland or England the following morning." Then in 1898, he started up the Blind Alley of kite flying as a way to experiment on equilibrium and stability. It led him to his last notable inspiration in technology, one that, like the telephone, was an unexpected offshoot, dwarfing the fruitless main stem of his research. He had taken up the lately invented Hargrave or box kite and expanded it into huge kites of several box-like cells. Seeking a frame as strong and yet as light as possible, he began combining and arranging triangles, which, unlike rectangular elements, needed no internal bracing. Then on August 25th, 1902, in a rush of inspiration like that of the telephone conception, he suddenly saw the structure implications for a pyramidal figure with three triangular sides and a triangular base, saw them, in fact, before he was sure of the geometric term for it, tetrahedron. One of the most remarkable pages in Bell's notebooks is the one of that date in which he sketched the form and added, "I believe it will prove of importance not only in kite architecture, but in forming all sorts of skeleton frameworks for all sorts of constructing, a new method of architecture. May prove a substitute for arches and bridge work generally, whole structures so solid and so perfectly braced by its construction that it may be treated as a solid body, may be used for ceilings of large buildings, etc. All the parts can be made of metal and made cheaply." This was a clear vision of what later became to be known as space-framed architecture, made famous by Buckminster Fuller. Yet, though Bell patented it, publicised it, and demonstrated it with a light but soaring tower on Ben Vrier, its time had for some reason not come. Many years later, it was reinvented independently and widely used. Bell insisted in his quest for flight, engaging as his assistant a young engineer, Frederick Casey Baldwin, as a successor to Watson and Tainter. Eventually, Bell brought together a high-spirited group of other young men, including Glenn Curtis, organised as the Aerial Experiment Association. The Wright brothers had by then risen above their own kite experiments to create a true airplane, and so the AEA built on that, developing successful machines. Bell himself conceived the important feature known as the aileron or wing flap, unaware that the French had anticipated him. In 1908, Bell and Casey Baldwin began a long series of experiments to improve hydrofoil boats, which had lately been introduced in Italy. Baldwin did the designing while Bell contributed suggestions and critiques. In 1919, their fourth experimental hydrofoil craft, HD4, set a world marine speed record of 70.86 miles an hour, a record that stood for 10 years. Since his youth, Bell had craved recognition as a scientist. His work in vocal physiology won him some measure of that. For years, he also dabbled privately in grand though nebulous theories of gravitation, energy, and other aspects of physics. But like Edison, and indeed most American physicists of that period, he lacked the mathematical sophistication increasingly necessary for theoretical work, and he was realistic enough to refrain from publishing his speculations. He did, however, win the high honour of election to the National Academy of Sciences and contributed 5 papers to the Academy's proceedings, mostly on aspects of heredity. Some other scientific papers grew out of his inventive work. Bell's most notable scientific work dealt with deafness. He helped apply his telephone as an audiometer for measuring degrees of deafness. His name eventually entered the language in the standard measure of relative differences in sound intensity, the decibel. More fundamental were his studies of inherited propensity to deafness, of which he found some evidence. Bell's interest in heredity drew him into an early stage of the movement called eugenics, or genetic upgrading, of the human race. Fortunately, his good sense and innate decency saved him from following that movement to its eventual contamination with racism, of which he was an active foe. He addressed his research instead to the innocuous question of whether long life was hereditary. He concluded that it seemed to run in families, but could not distinguish clearly from inherited physical stamina or disease resistance. Bell also left his mark on science as a patron and organiser. In 1881, he financed a major phase of Albert Michelson's classic experiments, establishing that direction had no effect on the speed of light. In 1882, he rescued the foundering journal Science and helped to finance it for nearly a decade. Later, the American Association for the Advancement of Science adopted it as its official journal, and it flourishes today as the voice of the world's greatest scientific community. And not least, Bell, himself a world traveller, advanced scientific exploration and communication as president of the National Geographic Society and as a shrewd advisor to the Society's magazine, edited by Bell's brilliant son-in-law, Gilbert H. Grosvenor. Despite all his other projects, Bell remained faithful to his lifelong work for and with the deaf. In Scotland, he helped launch a public day school for deaf children. Later in Washington, he opened his own private school for deaf children and conducted it with love, skill and zeal. He also became a champion, mentor and longtime friend of the blind and deaf Helen Keller, who dedicated her autobiography to him. When he was past 70, she wrote to him, "You've always shown a father's joy in my successes and a father's tenderness when things have not gone right." His dominating passion for his love of children, Helen once wrote, "He loved to visit classes, and the children loved to see him. During one such visit to a school for the deaf, he reported to Mabel, 'Some of the youngest children somehow got the idea that I was no less an individual than Santa Claus. The children were much puzzled to know how so big a body could come down so small a chimney. I taught them the word squeeze so that they will never forget it. I'm afraid that half the school will write to me before Christmas, and I shall have to visit the school in appropriate costume.'" Bell gave the cause of the deaf nearly $500,000, a sizable share of his income over the years. Some went in small sums to distressed individuals, most to schools and associations for the deaf. More importantly, Bell gave leadership and weight of his eminence to the cause as he saw it, to conquer the solitude of deafness in any way possible. He campaigned for public day schools where deaf children could learn without being cut off from their families and the hearing world. The world and all that is in it is our theme. That was Alexander Graham Bell's expansive advice to young Gilbert Grosvenor as a newly appointed editor of the National Geographic magazine. It perfectly described the mind and spirit of Bell himself. In the last months before his death in 1922, Bell remained true to his nature, working on devices to condense fresh water for those adrift at sea, encountering the newest household marvel, a radio, and remembering a musical tome he had heard upon, sending an intermittent current directly through his ears half a century before. He wondered if someone might one day hear the radio concert without any special receiver at all. Perhaps he was dreaming of music for Mabel. So he entered as he began, exploring the world and everything in it, captivated by its multiplicity of possibilities. However many blind alleys it led him into, Bell's passion for miscellany also brought him to insights and humanitarian achievements, any one of which would have made a lifetime fulfilling for most of us. And even if Bell's lifetime of seeking and helping had brought him nothing else, it would have brought him joy. There, too, may lie a moral for our specialised times. That was a special tribute to Alexander Graham Bell by the National Geographic magazine, of which he was once president.
This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. And now for some of your letters.
Dave Hill writes from Bolton in Lancashire and says, I found your programme very interesting, entertaining and informative. Thank you very much for that.
And thank you to W.D. Griffiths from Swansea in Wales for your letter. And from also Wales Mountain Ash, Mid Glamorgan, being in a valley pocket and surrounded by electrical equipment, interference is sometimes very bad. But I am delighted to say your programmes have been clear and strong. The history of BASF tapes was very interesting and edifying. Says G.P. Edwards from Abersinon, Mountain Ash.
And from Horsham in Sussex, we had a letter which said, I heard a talk on videos and then a talk on business spies. This was very interesting indeed. And that's from Dr. Ansel from Horsham.
From Finland, Leif Blomqvist from Helsinki. I found the professional features on broadcasting very, very interesting, and I also liked the music that you played. I was listening to you while staying at our summer house on the west coast of Finland, the Gulf of Bothnia. It is much better to listen to stations from your part of Europe there than in Helsinki, where my permanent residence is. Thank you, Leif Blomqvist.
And thank you also to Willy Schneider, who comes from Neumünster, West Germany, who says, I know you have an informative programme about radio and electronic scene. And we want to say again, thank you for the letter, but also thank you for sending us a tape of Radio Fax.
And I have recently had the great pleasure of listening to your station on 1611 here in Norway, says Kai M. Mauseth from Anneby in Norway, who's LA2TO. Thank you.
Robert Stewart from Glasgow has written, I heard the other day that your broadcast will have to stop in December. I naturally hope that you can find some way of staying on the air. Your programmes are some of the best on the radio. Best of luck, Robert Stewart from Glasgow. Well, thank you very much. We obviously would like to stay on the air, and you'll be hearing a little bit more from us about how we will hopefully do this as time goes on.
Although this is my first letter to Radio Fax, I have been listening to your station for several weeks now. I have been somewhat intrigued by the programme format. It was interesting to note that it is the same transmitter which is used on both medium wave and shortwave. I cannot think of many other examples of broadcasters that do this. The only ones that come to mind are the BBC Start Point transmitter site, which had a transmitter operating on shortwave by day and medium wave by night during World War II, and from Radio Africa, Radio Nacional de Angola, which about 20 years ago installed two 100 kilowatt transmitters operating on shortwave by day and medium wave by night. I shall conclude with some radio news from up here in Nottinghamshire. This is from Mike Burden, which you may like to mention on the air. On Tuesday, the 4th of October, a new commercial radio station opened up here in the East Midlands. Called GEM AM, GEM standing for Great East Midlands, it is a 24-hour per day oldies station, including news and sports, which uses the two medium wave outlets formerly used by Radio Trent, i.e. Derby 954 kHz, 0.3 kilowatts, and Nottingham 999 kHz, 0.25 kilowatts, and the one formerly used by Leicester Sound, 1260 kHz, 0.29 kilowatts. Radio Trent and Leicester Sound, meanwhile, continue on their FM channels only. Thank you, Mike Burden, from Norwell, Newark in Nottingham.
And from Cheshire, we have a letter from Patrick Jeffers, who's a language teacher there. He says he first came across our programmes on 1611 kHz several weeks ago, since when he's enjoyed a number of interesting features, for example, the history of the Start Point station, DBS antenna design, psychology on radio and TV, etc., etc., etc. Daytime reception, he says, on shortwave is satisfactory to excellent. He looks forward to further improving his knowledge of broadcasting development. Well, thanks very much indeed again to Mr. Jeffers from Sandbach in Cheshire.
And thank you to Bill McVeigh from Belfast in Northern Ireland for your letter and the details about the Northern Ireland Shortwave Listeners League, which you might be interested in if you live in the north of Ireland. Our league is aiming to promote and encourage the hobby of shortwave listening throughout Northern Ireland. Whether you are an established listener or a newcomer to our exciting hobby, whether your interests lie in amateur SWLing or in broadcast listening, the Northern Ireland Shortwave Listeners League is for you. Well, you can obtain details about this organisation, which has an annual membership fee of £8, which includes provision of newsletters, certificates and logbooks and so on, from 27 Bloomfield Road, Belfast, BT5 5LR. That's the Northern Ireland Shortwave Listeners League.
And Harry Hogberg from Hemar in Norway writes, and first thing he confesses is that his favourite hobby is actually listening to foreign radio stations, and especially interested in Ireland and the UK because of the variety of local stations that can be heard. Thank you very much to Harry Hogberg.
And from Bridgnorth in Shropshire, just a few lines to say how much we enjoy your broadcasts and sorry to hear on your programme this morning that you will have to close at the end of December due to new legislation. Thank you, Charles Fogg from Highley, Bridgnorth, Shropshire in England.
Stuart Allen from Halifax, West Yorkshire, says he's been listening to our shortwave service since we first started and it's very informative indeed. And a good station, good luck, etc. So thank you very much indeed for that.
From Finland, many thanks for your nice and interesting programme. I'm 33 years old, married and have two children. I work as a doctor in Kiti, a small town with a population of 11,500 situated in eastern Finland, some 350 kilometres northeast of Helsinki, the capital. Thank you once again for your good programme. And thank you, Dr. Jari Korhonen, from Kiti, Finland, for your letter. And I think that's enough speaking for Maggie with that appalling cold. From The Times, the BBC has apologised for running a winner car contest on its newest local radio station, Radio Gloucestershire, after complaints from a rival station that it was in breach of the corporation's charter. Seven Sound, Gloucestershire's commercial station, said the Peugeot Talbot competition was an attack on its own livelihood.
Got somewhere to go, but won't you make yourself at home and stay with me? And don't you ever leave. Lay down, Sally, and rest here in my arms. Don't you think you want someone to talk to? Lay down, Sally, don't need to leave so soon. I've been trying all night long just to talk to you. Got the moon and stars above. Underneath the velvet skies, love is all that matters. Won't you stay with me? Don't you ever leave. Lay down, Sally, and rest here in my arms. Don't you think you want someone to talk to? Lay down, Sally, and no need to leave so soon. I've been trying all night long just to talk to you. Mm-hmm. see the morning light, color in your face so dreamily. Said, don't you go and say goodbye, you can lay your worries down and stay with me. Don't you ever leave, lay down, Sally, and rest here in my arms. Don't you think you want someone to talk to?
Now let's see what Media Network's been up to.
Media Network, the most information allowed by law.
We had quite a lot of reaction to last week's story about the offshore broadcasting venture Radio New York International. In the last 7 days, several offshore radio stations have made the news. Anchored in international waters off the Israeli coast, a few miles north of Tel Aviv, an independent broadcasting venture called The Voice of the Gazelle has begun tests on 918 kilohertz medium wave. They started, in fact, last Friday. BBC Monitoring have confirmed hearing the transmission, which is mainly music and some relays of news from the Voice of Israel. It appears the shipborne transmissions are of 10 kilowatts in power, and tests will continue until November the 4th. After that date, a Hebrew program for the Jewish settlers on the West Bank will commence, with what's claimed to be more positive news than that heard on Israeli domestic stations. The Hebrew name, Kol Hatzvi, is a reference to the biblical name for the land of Israel. Meanwhile, in Boston, Massachusetts, USA, last Friday saw a court case between the Federal Communications Commission and some of the people behind pop music ship Radio New York International. RNI contests that the FCC have no jurisdiction over the airwaves from international waters. The FCC say that the United States doesn't recognize the Principality of Sealand, a self-proclaimed concrete fort now in British territorial waters. RNI, you see, was flying the Sealand flag during its broadcasts 11 days ago. Judge McNaught in Boston said his restraining order on the radio ship Sarah would remain in force, and a decision is due on November 4th. That's a week tomorrow. Tom Sundstrom in New Jersey pointed out to us that it's just over 15 years ago that a converted World War II minesweeper took to the airwaves as Radio Free America. Reverend Carl McIntyre was defrocked in the 1930s by the mainstream Presbyterian Church in America. So, from a base in New Jersey, he set about creating his own denomination, based on a fiery hatred of communism and Catholicism. In the mid-60s, he bought a station on the outskirts of Philadelphia called WXUR. It broadcast some very right-wing material until July of 1973, when the FCC refused to renew the station's license. In the last minutes of WXUR on the evening of July 5th, Carl McIntyre sat in a studio with a telephone by his side for last-minute calls of support.
My freedom to preach and the freedom of individual Americans to hear the word of God has been denied me and them in a media of communication which God has given to mankind. I fight for all radio and TV to have permanent licenses and to be as free as the press. It is a government which designs to take care of our speech for us that has become the tyrant of old, which our fathers resisted unto death. Hello? Yes.
Dr. McIntyre?
Yes.
Is this Dr. McIntyre?
But the Federal Supreme Court had refused to intervene in the case, so WXUR had to sign off.
All right, WXUR, it's 10 minutes Take it away for Onward Christian Soldiers.
In the middle of September 1973, McIntyre had transferred enough broadcasting equipment to a ship and anchored off the coast at Cape May. Tom Sundstrom explained to me that the engineers were astonished that McIntyre had chosen a wooden boat, which couldn't be earthed very easily.
Yes, he went to sea in a wooden boat that had plenty of floating RF on the table and shocking the announcers, keeping them awake every time the transmitter keyed on. But the background was kind of interesting. I was writing a magazine column called DX Corner for a magazine called S9, published out of Long Island. I had called the local all-news radio station for some information, thinking that they would have some current material for me. It turned out that they interviewed me on the air because I knew more than their announcers did. And the questions put to me were speculation on the frequencies. And I suggested 1610 being clear of the interference and 1160 as the likely of a frequency for an in-band frequency, given that only a daytime Chicago station and KSL were on there at night, plus a Brazilian. The next day, I didn't think anything of it, and my wife said, here comes a real estate salesman to the door, and I said, get rid of him. And the real estate salesman said, hello, I'm Reverend Moon, and Carl McIntyre would like to talk to you. Can you call him on the phone? And Carl McIntyre and I spoke, and he said, how did you come up with those frequencies? And I said, basic propagation knowledge for anybody interested in broadcast band DXing. To make a long story short, the station showed up on 1160. That day I had to go to work. Unfortunately, I can't play radio all the time, so I set up a timer. And when I came home on my tape recorder, I found bird chirps that sounded very much like the bird interval signal for RAI out of Italy. And is saying, hello, and this is Carl McIntyre coming to you from the good ship Lollipop off the Cape May coast.
This is our third attempt, and we're here. We're on the air. Radio Free America. And let all the people say what? Amen. It's been done by the help of God. It's been done as a great victory for faith and for freedom and for the free exercise of religion. We're on the air, folks. Carl McIntyre.
The broadcast only lasted a few hours and went off by sunset after a bogus claim from a station in Lakewood of co-channel interference.
What happened then? Was it a one-day wonder?
It was a one-day wonder. The ship came back to the port. I don't remember the details after all these years without referring to my notes, but the transmitter was offloaded and stored in the Cape May warehouse. The ship was returned to the original owners because, as I recall, lease payments were not made on the ship in whatever manner they were supposed to have been, and it never sailed again. A couple of weeks after that, I had another call from McIntyre asking me for the suggestions for four frequencies because he had intentions of putting four ships around the United States. And we talked about that, but it never went anyplace after that.
Now, thanks to Tom Sundstrom for digging up that material. Meanwhile, repairs on board a radio ship in the North Sea seem to have been made. On Saturday, a transmitter on board the Ross Revenge ship started relaying the Dutch language program Radio 558 on both 558 kilohertz and reactivated 819 kilohertz medium wave. On November 5th, Radio 558 is expected to become Radio 819. It's perhaps the only transmitter in Europe broadcasting cigarette commercials, which must be some clue as to who's financing the operation. One of the disc jockeys on board the floating radio station is Colin Peters, and I asked him whether life isn't rather lonely out there in the stormy North Sea.
Well, I think you have to be the type of person who can stand being lonely, as you call it, because I don't really think it's lonely, because we're at least with up to 14 people on board, and if everything works out fine, we get along fine, and we do at the moment. The atmosphere is very good, so you never really feel alone unless you're really a claustrophobic person.
The other problem, though, must be the North Sea, because especially around about, let's say around about this time of year, it gets a bit choppy.
It does, yeah. As we don't have a mast as big as we used to, the ship is a bit jumpy at the moment.
So, is Radio 558 Radio Monique as it was?
No, it isn't. It's a completely new station.
But what are the plans now?
Just to get a really good station, an MOR station in the air.
And is it mostly young people on the ship?
Yeah, I think the age is around 22.
Nothing but a load of anoraks, that lot. Jonathan Marks there on Radio Netherlands Media Network. And if you want to pick it up that well, you need one of these devices. Are you interested in improving AM reception? We are now producing a PhaseLock AM synchronous detector unit. There are four controls on the front panel. Loop, wide, medium or narrow, allows use with unstable signals or transmitters carrying phase-modulated radio data. Next, a selector provides low distortion envelope detection, double sideband, lower sideband, upper sideband, independent sideband or stereo spread, giving intriguing effects with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, and quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and allows audio from any weaker co-channel station to be heard more clearly. The remaining two controls are center frequency and window on-off, which enables the unit to hold lock tenaciously, even under severe interference or complete fade-out. Apart from the well-known benefit of reducing the gross distortion of selective fading, synchronous detection also provides an improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. The remaining objectionable effect during a selective fade is the surging in audio level, as the receiver AGC unnecessarily increases the gain. So our unit also includes a broadcast quality multiple time constant audio limiter. The complete boxed unit costs £150, and a detailed information sheet is available if you send along one 14 pence British stamp or one international reply coupon to Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
With the poor people of this earth, I want to share my fate. The streams of the mountains please me more than the sea.
Birmingham Cable wins UK's largest cable franchise. Birmingham Cable has been awarded the prime cable franchise for Birmingham and Solihull, reports Electronics Weekly. When completed, the franchise will be the UK's largest, covering a total of 465,000 homes, costing an estimated £160 million over an 8-year period. Birmingham Cable is owned by a consortium of companies which includes the Cable Corporation, already the owner of Windsor Television, and US West, a regional Bell operating company from the United States. Like Windsor Television, which operates in the Slough, Windsor and Maidenhead area, the Birmingham franchise will offer telephone services as well as cable television to business and domestic premises. Nicholas Meering-Smith, Managing Director of Birmingham Cable, believes the company's experience of providing telecommunications through Windsor Television was an important factor in the Birmingham success. The company plans to connect its first business subscribers in the autumn of 1989. The other contender for the Birmingham franchise was West Midlands Cable Communications, which had emphasised the importance of using microwave television while the cable network is being constructed. However, there is some uncertainty whether the government will favour the implementation of microwave video distribution based on 12.5 GHz technology, which is unlikely to be available in time for use in the Birmingham franchise. And now the ITV programme from Thames Television this week has been looking at the future of satellite television.
The new satellite enterprises have some powerful political backing. Last month in Luxembourg, Mrs. Thatcher came to call. The endorsement of satellite services is part of her broader assault on the television establishment. The present target is ITV, which a year ago she described as the last bastion of restrictive practices. That bastion has now crumbled somewhat and will crumble further if people can be induced to buy their own satellite dishes. In the months to come, potential subscribers are going to be persuaded to extend their viewing. Your own rooftop dish currently costs at least £500. With the new services on stream next year, manufacturers will be offering them for £200 upwards. Even then, not all the services will be free. For the better movies, you'll be paying extra. One way to tune to the future is to get cabled up if you live in the right area. Cable company subscriptions now cost between £6 and £25 a month. With the launch of Astra due in December, the satellite revolution in British television is now ready for blast-off. But there's much more to the new era in television than space stations alone. Down here on Earth, the government has radical plans to change what must now be called the terrestrial channels. There'll be at least one more commercial station, and the existing channels will be dramatically affected. It's probably the biggest shake-up since the little box in the corner became part of our everyday lives. The people most affected by the shake-up are the ITV chiefs who this week arrived to confer in a Scottish hotel. This is an annual strategy conference, but never have the omens been more unsettled. The initial pressure may be financial, but that is soon translated into what ITV viewers will see or will not see on their screens. Given the sharp need to face down the new services, there is now consensus that certain sorts of programmes are under threat, specifically those programmes which go to make up ITV's public service role.
In a highly competitive world where you're competing with other channels for the same sort of finance, there will tend to be a premium on those programmes that attract the highest audiences.
Richard Dunn, chairman of the Independent Television Association, speaking there.
Or that attract the highest amount of advertising revenue. And so certain types of programmes of lower interest, of minority concern, will be threatened in that environment.
What sorts of programmes might be threatened?
The programmes that might be threatened are the regular current affairs programmes, the religious programmes, the programmes of interest to small minorities, adult education programmes, programmes of interest to particularly small sports minorities or whatever.
Do you believe yourself that they will go?
No, I don't. I don't believe that they will go, but I haven't seen the white paper yet.
The government's plans for the future of broadcasting will be published as a white paper next month. Their effect, perhaps their purpose, will be to put the squeeze on ITV. There will be a new Channel 5 by 1993, which may cut ITV's advertising revenue. ITV is likely to lose its control over Channel 4 advertising. A new commercial television authority may demand fewer public service programmes on ITV. Finally, there will be an auction for ITV's regional franchises in 1992. It's all part, as the government sees it, of preparing ITV for the rigorous 90s. Nearest the camera, in Downing Street, one of the country's most influential media consultants.
The vision of broadcasting in the 90s is one of an industry which behaves more like industries in other sectors, the industries that produce washing machines or cars or advertising services.
Dr. Charles Johnshire speaking.
An industry in which one has to compete to survive, one has to combine quality with low cost, in which there is a good deal of international trade. Already we're seeing much more international trade in programmes at higher prices, which realistically reflect their cost of production. And the feeling is that if the old guard of British broadcasting, the ITV and the BBC, stayed essentially as they were, they would not be fit to fight in that new world. And domestically, they would lose out to the new satellite entrepreneurs, and internationally, they would lose out to other providers in that international market.
Those items from the Thames Television programme this week. Reporting was Peter Gill.
May you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. May you never make your bed out in the cold. May you never lose your temper if you get hit in a barroom fight. Sister to me, and I know that your love is true, and you hold no blame to stab me in my back. I know that the sun would do. So please, won't you please, won't you bury tonight? Love is a lesson to learn in our time. Please, won't you please, bury tonight for me. And may you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. You just never make your bed out in the cold. May you never lose your temper if you get hit in a barroom fight. May you never lose your woman overnight. Well, you're just like a great strong brother to me, never talk dirty behind my back. I know that the sun never do. So please, won't you please, won't you bury the mind? Love is a lesson to learn in a hard time. Please, won't you please, bury the mind for me. May you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. May you never make your bed out in the cold. May you never lose your temper if you get hit in a barroom fight. May you never lose your woman overnight. May you never lose your woman overnight. May you never lose your
And with the imminent broadcasting white paper, everybody's been looking at the future of broadcasting. Now to Channel 4.
This media show special program entitled TV 2000 is brought to you by Channel 4 Television, makers of innovative TV entertainment for discerning minorities.
And the programme was introduced by Muriel Gray.
Hello and welcome to the future. Yes, this is exactly what the future is going to look like. Raimondo's unisex hair salon in Coatbridge gives you something to live for, doesn't it? But what's it all in aid of? Well, tonight this special live edition of the media show peers into a rather murky crystal ball to see what our television sets may be delivering into our homes by the year 2000. Now, there's been an enormous amount of speculation and discussion recently about the changes coming up in broadcasting, but most of it's about DMAC versus HDTV, Intelsat and Ariane, technological garbage to most of us, and about as interesting as reading a computer instruction manual in a doctor's waiting room. But what about the programmes? What are we actually going to receive on our super transponder DMAC PAL decoder squareals? Well, we hope between now and 10:45 to give you some idea of what the year 2000 could be like.
Later in the programme, they looked at regulation of pornography from satellite services, with Claire Mulholland, who is Deputy Director of Television at the Independent Broadcasting Authority, and Kate Adie. First of all, Claire Mulholland.
Whatever.
OK, well, thanks a lot. Well, Claire, can I just ask you, obviously it's going to be very hard, almost impossible to regulate that kind of material in the year 2000. Does that worry you?
Well, I don't think it's impossible to regulate. I mean, just to go back to what you said earlier about children can go in and buy printed pornography now, they can't. I mean, on the law, one isn't allowed to sell pornography to children.
Well, they still get hold of it, though, don't they?
Yes, but I mean, not legally. That's the. So if we look at if one can prevent, introduce laws to, or regulation to restrict the distribution, then I think that's clearly what one would expect to be done.
But how can you do that with satellite? Any country can just decide to beam anything in and you can't do anything about it. Well, you won't be able to then.
Well, I think there's a long way to go in terms of international distribution. I mean, the government has indicated that it would be concerned, and that could be discussed with European neighbours in terms of European legislation. But I think, I mean, some of the clips you showed, as you said, we wouldn't expect to see on our screens at all now, have actually gone out on European channels now, either on subscription or something.
Oh, yes, we made that point very clearly. We didn't just make that up. It's not on video. Yeah. That is actually being broadcast now. Kate, do you think that's offensive, or do you think people should have the right to just be able to subscribe to anything they want in their homes?
I'm not sure if that's the actual question, because I think it's going to be not whether they should, but whether people are going to in the future. I don't think you're going to have in the year 2000 lots of elderly gentlemen or people like ourselves sitting around saying what people can or can't see. That decision, as the families have said at home in Aberdeen and London, is going to be a decision taken in the home. And I think most of the arguments which are about sex and violence and standards on television normally centre around, you know, who makes the decision? And up to now, it's been regulating bodies. The government has got in on the act now. There's going to be a council, or going to be rather wise people sitting around. I think that'll be out of the window by the year 2000. And the onus is going to come on viewers. And that is a very big decision for most viewers. It's not just a trivial matter. It is a matter of what you are going to allow your family to see. And are you going to sit with them all the time? Just like videos, children can go down to the corner shop, and right now there are children watching material which their parents probably don't approve of. They're going to have to take the decision, though, and I think it's going to shift the argument about who decides, because this stuff is going to come in. There is absolutely no hope in anybody's mind, particularly the government's, I think, to discuss regulating the stuff from the skies. That's not on. That is a lot of pie-in-the-sky nonsense.
OK, then.
Channel 4's media show, presented there by Muriel Gray.
Changed a lot.
Radio Facts will finish in December. We have been on the air for 3 months, and through that time you have been sending us over 100 letters each week telling us how much this kind of speech programming is appreciated. We also know that we have a fair number of very enthusiastic blind listeners. So, we remain a legal operation and close down in December, unless some government writes us out the licence we have been asking for since 3 years ago. What would the other possible options be? We could stay on the air from the Republic of Ireland, or we could come on the air from England. By making public the time and place, this would be a fairly straightforward act of civil disobedience, and the, presumably inevitable, court case would form part of the history of broadcasting. If hundreds of you write to say that is what you think we should do, then I suppose we would have to consider it seriously. But we have to make it clear now that these are not options we regard as compatible with a professional operation.
The letters you send are what has made this project worthwhile, and thank you again to everyone who's taken the trouble to write. We get letters from people aged between 17 and 70, and anyone in the media world will know that something appealing to such an age range is most unusual. Some of the historical items we have carried are development of magnetic tape, the story of radar, old BBC transmitting stations, the invention of magnetic recording from wire recorders to digital tape, and others have brought in letters from people involved in the work for up to 50 years ago. If we were staying on the air, one thing we would like to do was organise a contact point so that people who worked together years ago could get in touch with each other again.
One thing we have achieved might be the most listened to programme per watt transmitted. And we mean listened to. Many shortwave stations are heard and logged, but your letters make it clear that people do listen to Radio Facts.
The use of shortwaves has fallen significantly over the last 20 years, and everyone seems agreed that with a view to the future, what Radio Facts has demonstrated is now a useful and appropriate use of 9 kHz of the spectrum. What can you do? Well, if you think Radio Facts or something like it should be offered a licence, you could write to your Member of Parliament at the House of Commons, London SW1A OAA.
And a story in the Financial Times by Peter Bruce in Madrid about RTVE. Mr. Felipe González, Spain's Prime Minister, is considering whether to ask one of his closest friends, Ms. Pilar Miró, Director General of Spanish Radio and Television, RTVE, to resign after revelations that she has spent public money on expensive clothes. A scandal has erupted around Ms. Miró in the past few weeks as newspapers have published leaked copies of receipts made out to her and showing that she has spent about £5,700 on clothes and jewellery this year and another £11,400 in 1987 via her Gold Visa company credit card. Metal-voiced Ms. Miró, who has commanded RTVE with an iron fist for the past 3 years, has made many enemies along the way, and the press has been recording in loving detail receipts showing that she spent 55,000 pesetas each on 3 skirts, 85,000 pesetas on a handbag, and 37,400 pesetas on a purse, among other items. Ms. Miró has offered to pay back the money, but said her job required that she be well dressed.